This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We asked the Commerce Department how well prepared it was for the president's steel and aluminum tariffs, specifically the companies that didn't want to pay those tariffs. Commerce told us today, so now we are going to tell you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 5th of November today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to start with a number and an acronym on this Monday. The number is 232. That's the section of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, under which President Trump imposed his steel and aluminum tariffs back in March. The acronym is FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, under which Marketplace petitioned the government to find out how well the Commerce Department was equipped to handle those tariffs and how they would impact companies in this economy. We asked because trade and tariffs has taken up a lot of our airtime lately, right? And we wanted to dig in a little bit deeper to get a better sense of what the government knew and when it knew it, specifically what it was going to do about the companies who applied for what are called exemptions or exclusions to those tariffs and so would have to, in theory, not pay them. Anyway, we got our first response to that FOIA request today. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has been reading through it all day long. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
So what did we get back from Commerce? What do we know now?
Well, we got some info, definitely not everything that we asked for, but it's a start, and we're going to be asking for some more. So one of the things we wanted to know was how staff were trained to review these applications, what kind of rules and criteria they're using to make decisions, how public comments and objections to these exemption requests were being handled. And we did get a better look at the training process, specifically one document that's used in what seems like a 3-hour crash course on metals. It starts with really basic information like what is a metal, literally, that's in there.
Like literally? What is a metal?
Yep. Wow. And then it gets super technical, super fast. It's 120 pages long about how aluminum's produced or steel is forged. By the time we get to page 58, trainees get a 10-minute break. At page 100, they get a 5-minute break. So we don't know exactly who got this training, but it does seem like it's meant for people with little or no background in the steel and aluminum industry. And other documents make reference to the additional staff that Commerce has had to bring on board to review this these applications. Yeah. We know that they were initially expecting 4,500 exemption requests and that it's gotten more than 10 times that, some 50,000.
Wow. So if that's what we know, what don't we know, if that question makes any sense, right?
Yeah, what's missing and what we asked for, it's a lot of the good stuff, the stuff that we're really curious about, like how they are making these decisions. So. Right. We did get another 100-page document, and this one was a manual, and in it you can see this table of contents that includes these checklists, and there's a checklist for evaluating exemption requests and another one for evaluating objections. Like, that's the stuff that got me really excited. You go to those pages, big black boxes.
Redactions, right? Literally, it's just black boxes printed on a page.
They cover up the information so you can't see it. And when I showed these documents to a few trade lawyers who were advising clients in this process, they said, you know, that's the stuff they wanted to see, and that's the hard part of this process, right? It's how do you vet conflicting information from someone who wants an exemption and someone who doesn't want one, a company that says, you know, we need to import this steel and aluminum thingamabob, and then a U.S. company who says, no, they don't need to. We can make it.
Right. And we've been calling those companies for months and months now, right? Companies who have been filing these exemption requests.
Exactly, because that's, right, that's right. Why this matters. Like, we are trying to understand this process so that we can understand if it's working fairly. And last week, in fact, we learned the Inspector General at Commerce is planning to audit Commerce to review its process and see whether these decisions are being made consistently and transparently. But we did talk to one of the people we've been checking in from time to time. His name's Sam Desai. And
Sam's a good guy.
Yeah, he has a company that produces stainless steel products that end up in things like washing machines. And he told us the tariffs have really changed his entire way of doing business.
Customers are still very reluctant to place orders, future orders. Our sales have gone down about 25% this year. There's just a lot of uncertainty in my world right now.
So he says he's applied for multiple applications. They've all been denied. He's working on appeals, but he's had little interaction with Commerce on his application, and he would have appreciated a little bit more information about how this process is working.
So fundamentally, he doesn't know how and or why this decision was made, right? It's basically opaque to him.
Right, yeah. And that's what we're trying to figure out as well.
Tracy Samuelson on the tariffs and the FOIA request that we filed for the Commerce Department. More on this story coming up as we get it. Also, some stuff online at marketplace.org later in the day. I'll explain that in a little bit. Tracy, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Before we go on, though, there is another story today of the government perhaps not being as prepared as it might have been to do what governments do. In this case, collect our taxes. The union that represents employees at the Internal Revenue Service, in a story first reported by Politico, we should say, that story says those workers aren't getting the training they need to implement the new tax law, which was, remember, the biggest overhaul of the Internal Revenue Code in a generation. And then back in September, the Treasury Department's Inspector General for Tax Administration warned that the IT systems, the computer systems at the IRS, might not be ready in time for tax season and the new tax law either. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
The new tax law is the first overhaul of the Internal Revenue Code in 30 years. And Lindsay Kashgarian with the Progressive Watchdog Group, the National Priorities Project, says the IRS has been scrambling to figure out all the details.
Tax forms and tax returns and everything have changed in really big ways, and the IRS has to deal with that. So it's not just a regular tax year for them.
And these changes couldn't have come at a worse time for the IRS. Its budget has been falling for years. Its workforce has shrunk by 15% since 2012. And then there's its geriatric computer system.
It's as if the system is held together with duct tape.
Mark Mazur at the Tax Policy Center in Washington, D.C., says the IRS uses technology that's decades old.
And every year they try to upgrade things, and they have made substantial improvements. But the basic backbone is still a very old system, one that is in constant need of attention.
Meanwhile, IRS workers say they're not getting enough training on the new tax law. Tony Reardon, president of the National Treasury Employees Union, says that may mean longer wait times for taxpayers who call the agency.
One of the potential outcomes of that is you've got people filing inaccurate returns because they're not able to get proper guidance.
In a statement, the IRS said it's well on its way to being ready for filing season. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
So on that FOIA story that Tracy was telling us about, how exactly do you suppose the tariff exemption process does work? We've got it at marketplace.org, some of the details. Also, we've included some of the documents released to us under the terms of that Freedom of Information Act request. Check it out. Once again, marketplace.org. Bit of a mixed bag on Wall Street today. No really big gyrations, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a great test case of politics versus capitalism happening in the global oil markets today. And in the short term, at least, capitalism's kind of winning. American sanctions against Iran kicked in at midnight last night, as you might have heard, the next step in President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Iranian nuclear deal. A key focus of those sanctions was, or is, I guess, Iran's most valuable commodity, its oil. Crude prices, though, are so far saying no big deal. For the longer-term analysis, we've called Tom Klose at the Oil Price Information Service. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So give me your sense, first of all, of the impact on the global oil market of these sanctions.
Not too much of an impact at the moment, because the sanctions did allow for eight countries, and some of the substantial importers mm-hmm. of Iranian crude to get a waiver for a while. So I think ahead of the election here, it's a nominal impact. Oil's actually moved a little bit lower this week, and it had a horrible October. But I think in the end, the handcuffs are going to mean that there's going to be less oil on the market, and oil prices are going to go higher.
And then American consumers, in theory, will see higher prices at the pump. I mean, that's the most obvious manifestation, right?
Yeah, and that's a manifestation that'll come later this winter.
Talk to me then, sort of big picture. There are a couple of things I want to run by you. First of all is the fact that oil is denominated in dollars. Countries are trying to get around these sanctions any way they can, but they're a little bit handicapped, right, by that dollar-denominated oil thing?
They are handicapped by that. They're also handicapped by the fact that the administration has put on some sort of handcuffs, financial handcuffs, on about 70 banks or similar institutions. So we're not going to be moving away from dollar-based payment for oil anytime soon. And that does make it easier to sort of implement some restrictions.
What about the idea that the Iranians, and I suppose the would-be purchasers as well, would be able to cheat the sanctions? They would just, you know, take their oil tankers and go out in the middle of the ocean, turn off their transponders and, you know, and do it that way.
I think the idea is that the administration wants Iran to come to the negotiating table and negotiate a tougher treaty on the nuclear issues. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it's going to be difficult to remove oil from the market and keep the prices temperate.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that he wants to get, and the administration, I suppose, wants to get Iranian oil exports to zero, that these waivers for the eight countries will eventually go away. What's your sense of timing on that, if you know, and what then might happen? Do you think they can get to zero, I guess, is the question.
I don't think they can get to zero because I have a hunch that they'll be moving some of the oil to places like Turkey or whatever under any circumstances. And if the Trump administration is really, really committed to seeing Iranian exports move to zero, you know, we might be talking about some sort of military intervention or monitoring or whatever. And that's likely to really shake up the region.
Tom Kloza at the Oil Price Information Service. Tom, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
No problem.
With Election Day just hours away and with the acknowledgement that, yes, millions of people have already voted, there are four little letters campaigns are focused on right now. GOTV. Get out the vote. And when you look at this country's history of voter participation in midterm elections, well, suffice to say those campaigns have a whole lot of work to do. But this year, some big companies have been pushing their employees to get to the polls, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
It's true that voter turnout in midterm elections historically hasn't been great, but it certainly doesn't help that we make elections happen on a workday. Dean Carter helps run HR at Patagonia, the outdoor brand.
In 2014, you know, almost 36% of people who were eligible to vote said there was some conflict between work or school and voting. So we thought, are we part of the problem?
This year, Patagonia and more than 300 companies are giving employees some paid time off to go vote. Patagonia is shutting its stores for the entire day. Others are trying to make Tuesday a little less of a drag.
We've already done a big calendar block on that day that reminds everybody to get out to vote and blocks their calendars from other meetings.
That's Anna Walker at Levi Strauss & Company, which is giving employees 2 to 5 hours off to vote, depending on their role. In fact, the Society for Human Resource Management says 44% of companies are giving workers paid time off on Election Day. Walker says Levi's employees have been telling the company they want to be more politically engaged.
They were participating in the Women's March, and the orientation was shifting that way, and they were asking us a lot of questions.
While the companies say the effort is nonpartisan, some companies have an interest in the outcome of the vote. Patagonia endorsed two Democrats running for Senate this year, John Tester in Montana and Jackie Rosen in Nevada. Michael McFaul, a political scientist at Stanford, published a letter encouraging companies and universities to provide paid time off for students and workers to vote. McFaul says hourly workers in the service sector, like retail employees, are the least likely to participate in elections because they don't have the flexibility of, say, a banker or a professor.
If you have kids and you got to pick up or dinner to put on the table, it's actually hard to vote. And so that creates resentment towards companies.
Some states require companies to provide time off to vote, but there's no federal law. McFaul says CEOs are best positioned to help improve voter turnout.
Just give people a couple hours of time to vote. They'll feel good about America. They'll feel good about their company. And they'll be more engaged in the political process.
At his restaurant in Davis, California, Ali Mohadam says he has gone over ballots with his staff before every election since 2008.
After the lunch rush between like 3 to 5, where it's kind of slow, I like go over it with them, and I like, if they have any questions about the propositions, I tell them like what it means and what I'll do and stuff like that.
He also forces his staff to get flu shots every year. And like a vaccine helps prevent others from catching the flu and missing work, he says helping employees vote makes sense from a business perspective, too.
You do this kind of thing, not only is it good for your business, it shows your coworkers that you care, and they end up appreciating and just being better workers for you.
He tends to lean libertarian and toward pro-business causes, but he says he tries to stay neutral when he helps his employees go to the polls. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The basic idea is to create something that is a portrait of a community's subconscious.
And then put it on television. Writer-director Terrence Nance, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 190 today, 0.75%, 25,461. The NASDAQ off 28, about 0.3%, 73.28. The S&P 500 lifted 15 points, 0.5%, 27.38. Talked about the metal business and tariffs, so we'll look at a couple of companies in the steel and aluminum sectors here. U.S. Steel boosted 0.3% today. Steel Dynamics was basically flat. In aluminum, Alcoa dropped 0.8%. Kaiser Aluminum rolled down 0.2% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.20%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. In a speech today in Shanghai, Chinese President Xi Jinping said something that might, in different trade policy times, be music to President Trump's ears. She said at the China International Import Expo that over the next 30 years, his country is going to become more of an import economy, which would be no small thing because China right now sells $500 billion more stuff overseas than it brings in. 3,000 companies and dozens of official delegations from all over the world are at the expo in Shanghai, but the United States government is sitting this one out. Marketplace Jennifer Pack has that.
China has been trying for months to create buzz around the Import Expo. Back in July, it held an event to unveil the expo's mascot.
3, 2, 1, start.
Since then, the skipping cartoon panda has appeared all over the streets of Shanghai. As the opening date approached, officials stepped up security here, and they shut down schools and government offices for the first 2 days of the expo. All because Chinese President Xi Jinping wants to show the world that China is getting more serious about imports. Right now, the country exports about $2.25 trillion a year worth of goods and services, but it imports only about $1.8 trillion.
China is now the second largest economy.
In this official expo video, China says it will increase imports more than fivefold to $10 trillion over the next 5 years. Historically, Chinese firms have mainly imported industrial machinery, transportation equipment, and oil, the things China needed so it could manufacture for the world. That helped make China's consumers richer, and the Beijing government wants them to be able to spend on goods from abroad. That would also help China's balance of trade, says Jake Parker with the U.S.-China Business Council in Beijing.
I think China is interested in showing the world that it's already beginning to shift away or lower its significant trade surpluses.
The expo will make that case to such dignitaries as Britain's Prince Andrew, the President of El Salvador, and the Prime Minister of Russia. But the U.S. government isn't sending anybody. And only 180 American firms are at the expo, just 6% of all exhibitors at the fair. They include Google, Ford, and a gourmet hot dog maker. Kenneth Jarrett with the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai says small firms in particular are enthusiastic about attending.
These are companies that maybe haven't penetrated China that much, and for them it is more of a genuine business opportunity, although ironically for the smaller companies it's much harder to get in the expo.
Harder because he says China's government wants big companies at the fair.
Because that's taken as a sign of success or kind of reaffirmation of the importance of the show.
In a statement announcing that the U.S. will not send a high-level delegation to the expo, an embassy spokesperson said China needs to make reforms to trade practices that are, quote, harming the world economy. The financial services sector has been a sticking point. While the Chinese government announced last November that it's loosening controls on the sector, Jake Parker with the U.S.-China Business Council says the reforms have been far too slow.
There's not a single U.S. credit rating agency that's licensed to rate domestic bonds in China. There's not a single bank card clearing institution company that's processing domestic transactions with a U.S. credit card.
He says American businesses want tangible, measurable outcomes. But that's not how China works, says Peter Alexander with the market intelligence group Zeben Advisors.
China is not a light switch when they look at reforms. It's not one day you can't, the next day you can. It's a little bit of red tape's loosened here, a new program is introduced there.
Alexander says the Import Expo is largely symbolic. But in China, symbolism matters. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Hollywood and television specifically are usually pretty risk averse. You find a formula, you make a show that follows that formula, lather, rinse, repeat. But every once in a while, you come across a show that is anything but risk averse. A show called Random Acts of Flyness on HBO is one of them. It's tough to categorize other than to say it's about race and this society in sometimes funny but often painful ways. Terrence Nance is the director and the creator. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I need you to give me the concept behind it. What's the basic idea of this thing?
The basic idea is to create something that is a portrait of a community's subconscious that has the potential to shift consciousness.
Wow. I mean, that was like 25 words and there's a whole lot in there. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, watching a couple episodes, it made me feel and think and wonder a whole lot. But probably what we need to do is get a little more concrete for the listeners to this interview, because mm-hmm. this is an intensely visual thing that you're putting on television. So I want you to tell me about the thing in the pilot with John Hamm and about that ointment, that infomercial that cures white thoughts.
Do you suffer from white thoughts? White thoughts are a symptom of an aggressive disease called acute viral perceptive albinitis.
First of all, give me the thumbnail sketch of that skit.
It's a infomercial where John Hamm is trying to sell white people a product that will dissolve their whiteness, and kind of posits that whiteness is a virus that congeal or collect economic and social power to perpetuate white supremacy. So, you know, he's saying you can dissolve it with this product.
You're just rubbing on your temples and you're cured.
It just goes away. At some point, the segment breaks, and like we kind of question whether, as black artists, focusing on white people and the extent to which they can dismantle white supremacy is even something we should do.
So, all right. So that John Hamm thing butts up against, and I can't remember in sequence whether it came before or after, a skit called, and maybe skit's the wrong word, but we can get to that, an element called Everybody Dies.
Yeah, Everybody Dies comes right before. Yeah.
Which, holy cow, is dark and oh my gosh. So give me the thumbnail sketch of that one so listeners can sort of understand where you're going here.
Yeah, Everybody Dies, you know, it originated as a short film written and directed by Noah Tamabadomo, who's one of the writers and directors on the show. But basically, it's about the flow of emotions that, you know, I experience at least, and I think a lot of black people experience when confronted with the fact that the state, as represented by the police, murders black people with impunity. And I think that flow of emotions goes from, like, anger, despair, into just like absurdity. And then obviously sometimes absurdity kind of morphs into something like laughter to keep from crying, and then kind of back into despair. And I think that's most embodied in like this character of the Grim Reaper, who you would think would have some ability to kind of be above the kind of human drama of state-sponsored violence killing black people. But because she's black, she can't even escape it. And I think that's heavily allegorical for my subjectivity experiencing that.
Take my hand, walk through the door, and you'll live in this world no more.
Whose consciousness are you trying to shift? Who are you doing this show for?
I think on some level it doesn't matter a little bit. You know, like I think that who ends up experiencing it is out of my control. But I do think that the only person or people that we can reliably make the show with the expectation that they will watch it is ourselves. I'm the first audience. The other creators are the first audience of the show. And then by extension, other members of our community who we're in dialogue with, and especially younger versions of ourselves.
Why TV, by the way? I mean, you've done feature films, you've done performance. Why TV for this?
You know, I think if you think about the words that we associate with television, you know, program, you know, what is a program? A set of instructions that will hopefully change how something behaves. What is a channel? What is channeling? Those concepts are really important to the idea of the show, which is to hopefully retool or be a means of retooling their point of view. You know, television is kind of uniquely suited and has always been a means of propagandizing or shifting consciousness in a variety of ways.
It's called Random Acts of Flyness on HBO. Terrence Nance. Terrence, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a cool show.
Thank you.
It's confusing as hell, but it's a cool show.
See, yeah, it'll make sense the more you, the more distance
the more I watch. All right, fair enough. This final note on the way out today, in which I repeat and stand by my earlier prediction that Jeff Bezos and Amazon are just funning with us on this whole HQ2 thing. There was a story you might have seen in the Washington Post over the weekend saying Bezos has all but settled on the D.C. area, where Bezos owns a home and the aforementioned hometown newspaper for his company's second headquarters. And then today, a story in the Wall Street Journal said, no, no, no. What the company's really going to do is split HQ2 between two cities, 25,000 new jobs apiece. My take? Bet you $10 the actual HQ stays right in Seattle. All right, we got to go. Dow up 190 today. NASDAQ was down. S&P 500 was up. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Maria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.